We stop at the feeding of the 5,000, page 135 of our synopsis, Mark chapter 6, 32 to 44. I want to spend time on this passage because of its importance. As you can see, it is an account that has been recorded by all four evangelists. It is basically a nature miracle. The multiple recordings of this nature miracle leads us to look deeper into the reasons why, of all the miracles, this one should be so outstanding. We have quite a number of healing miracles as well as exorcisms and a few nature miracles. However, this one is important not only because of the magnitude, but as some people suggest, because of its Eucharistic implications. What these are, precisely, needs to be explained. There is no exact parallel, mind you, because wine is not used. We have fish as well as bread, and fish is not used in Holy Communion. However, it does not require exact similarities, yeah? Or rather, it does not require an identity of the two events for some conclusions to be drawn. And we can just say that the significance of the bread that is used harks back to the manna in the wilderness and to the new manna, quote-unquote, Christ uses at the Last Supper. We should also think here of the multiple feedings. There are actually six accounts of Jesus feeding a multitude in the Gospels. We have this double account in Mark, 5,000 and the 4,000. We have the two parallel accounts also in Matthew, and John and Luke have one each. Perhaps this may be an indication that the early church regarded the feedings, these six feedings, as among the greatest and most important of the mighty works of Jesus, as far as the faith of the church is concerned. In verse 34, we read that Jesus, after going ashore, saw a great throng, and he had compassion on them. But the word that stands out is didaskein. Verse 34, he began to teach exato didaskein. It seems that the compassion of Jesus was not that these were a great number of people who had sicknesses. There is no indication here that there was a great number of people who were obviously sick, lying on stretchers and so forth. Neither was the compassion of Jesus linked with their hunger. I don't know whether you can look and tell whether someone is hungry. But there is no indication of the hunger there at this point. But the compassion which is linked with The description that they were like sheep without shepherd is primarily with their lack of teaching. It was the lack of teaching that caused Jesus to feel compassion. I don't know how you feel if you should go to a church to candidate. And from your talks with the members or from other indications, the thing that is outstanding about the situation which you are in is the lack of teaching. Okay, now Jesus felt compassion in that situation. And I think that in the case of a student who is candidating for a pastor, I think that would be a sufficient ground for wanting to serve the Lord in that needy situation. Okay? We notice that he didn't begin by healing. He could have. But he began by teaching. But the most interesting thing here is that Mark emphasizes the teaching. Matthew emphasizes the healing. If you look at the synoptic parallel, Matthew 14, verse 14. Kai etherapeusen. And he healed their sick. He had compassion on them, Matthew says. And he healed their sick. Okay? Mark says he had compassion and he taught them. You can see how two different points of view are expressed. The value of comparing synoptically the verses. Now, quite interestingly, look at Luke. Luke 9, verse 11. Luke says, Elalei, he spoke to them. Sorry, he had compassion on them. And after that, he says, Elalei, he spoke to them concerning the kingdom of God. And therapeias, iato, he cured, iato, from iaomai, he cured those who were having need of healing. Now, Luke here emphasizes both the teaching and the healing. It's a kind of conflation. But I won't want to use the word conflation here because Luke wrote independently of Matthew. Luke didn't have Matthew and Mark in front of him when he started writing. So he decided, well, I can't decide which one is the better one, so I'll put both in. No, I think Luke gives us his a third point of view. And that is that there was clearly, in that situation, there was clearly evident both the need for healing as well as the need for teaching. And each evangelist saw the situation in their particular perspective. From my own missionary experience in Bangladesh, in Calcutta, Indonesia, I can see the situation where compassion and eagerness and desire fit very well, you know. And I would much rather travel around if I didn't, if I could do it. You know, this I can understand why Paul would say it's better that a person remains unmarried if in his own situation he sees his work for the Lord as an itinerant preacher. But I've got my family and I cannot be gallivanting around the world. But there's nothing better I would like to do, really, than to go back to Calcutta and Dhaka, Bangladesh. Because the great need is there. Okay, so thanks for that note here concerning the welcoming. Wally? Yes, two in Mark, two in Matthew, one in Luke, one in John. Well, the 5,000 and 4,000 were separate. The feeding of the 5 and 4. No, there are 6 feeding accounts, generally speaking.
They're not 6 separate.
No, no. No, no, no. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah, those words could be misunderstood, I know. Okay. Well, I'm sure they had to eat more than six times, but... let's move on. If we compare Mark with the Synoptics, verse 39, we see too something of Mark's orientation when he writes. Mark was concerned to not only describe the incident itself, but the accompanying situation, the atmosphere. He brings up the scene of the events much better than the others. Now, it is the words, in the use of the word, chloro, epitochlorokorto, verse 39. Green grass. He commanded them to sit down on green grass, indicating springtime. Okay, you got that? This is just a little detail to note. Verse 41 now, over the page. Eulogesen. He pronounced a blessing. Now, Jesus took the role of the head of a Jewish household at meals when he broke bread and gave the blessing. But what kind of blessing did he pronounce? Commentators ask this kind of questions. They are curious. He said grace. What were the actual words of those grace? It's not far-fetched, incidentally, because the Jewish prayers were rather stereotyped in a certain sense, and it is possible to guess what kind of grace might have been said. Cranfield, page 219, says that Jesus pronounced the ancient beraka for bread, which goes as follows. Berakah is blessing, or Barakah. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the world, who bringest forth bread from the earth. Okay, there are various blessings that could be pronounced. Concerning these various blessings, rabbinical opinion says, it is forbidden for men to taste of this world without saying a blessing. Whoever tastes of this world without saying a blessing commits unfaithfulness. And it is a practice based on Leviticus 19:24, saying grace at meals, Leviticus 19:24, Deuteronomy 8:10. Okay, what did Jesus pray? Perhaps his blessing on the bread conformed to a set prayer. We don't really know, but it's interesting just to ask. In verse 41, the use of edidu is significant. And he was giving them to the disciples. Kai edidu tois mathetais autu. He was giving to the disciples in order that they might set before paratithosin them, the people. Okay, exactly how the miracle took place, we don't quite know. But we know very well that the loaves were not the kind of loaves as we think of loaves of bread today, which is a long rectangular loaf. But the loaves were rather, probably, more like a Jewish chapati, which is round in shape and hard. And what Jesus did, there were five of these. They couldn't have been very large, as they were a mother's estimate of a hungry boy's appetite. Now, quite likely, the loaves were in some bag or some basket carried by the boy, and he took just one of them, and after praying, broke that and gave it to the he would place it in the disciples' hands. And as he reached for more. Inside the bag, there was an unending stream. He kept giving to them. Okay, that's the impression that was given. Now, the problem here for Cranfield, but not for me, is the suggestion that the multitude, this is Cranfield said, it appears that the multitude were not aware that there was a miracle, that only the disciples were aware. The multitudes were spread out, far and wide, and Jesus stopped speaking, and suddenly they realized that food was coming, you know. They didn't know that there was food coming from, I think, and made known to him of this scene in the film Jesus. See, if you remember there, the people, a hush fell on the scene, and the whisper, he did it, or something of that sort. And then that whisper went up to a roar as it spread out right through, and the whole multitude was rejoicing. Well, if there was no miracle, one would find it hard to understand why Jesus would rebuke the people for coming to see him on subsequent occasion, expecting him to feed them. Okay, obviously the people wanted a repeat of that miracle. Undoubtedly, there is a miracle here, so let's not try to find other explanations. Cranfield accepts it as a miracle, but he makes a point from the incident which happened immediately after that, when Jesus sent the people, sent his disciples away quickly. The word would not spread to the rest of the people that it was a miracle. Well, let me just finish on this and I'll take your questions, okay? Now, we note first that it is a miracle. Second, that the food that was given was something very basic. Jesus did not give them a feast. The fish used in this incident is most likely, although the word used is ichthus in Mark. In John, we have another word that is used, John 11. Obsarion. Now in Luke we have the same word as Mark, Luke 9, verse 16, ichthus, as well as in Matthew 14, 19. But the obsarion would refer to not so much fish as we think of in a large sense, like salmon, but rather to the tiny fishes, which I don't know how you would regard this. Maybe they're more like the sardine kind of fishes than the salmon kind. Okay, we have a Asian word for this kind of fish, which you won't understand. But these were fish that were salted and preserved. You don't eat them fresh, but you just take them dry because... Well, they go well with certain kinds of food, okay? It was not a feast. It was enough to satisfy their hunger. The, as Cranfield says, the austerity of this feeding is reminiscent of the manna in the wilderness. Numbers 11, verse 6, rather than of the sumptuous fare of the eschatological feast. Isaiah 25:6. Numbers 11:6. Isaiah 25:6. So there's a further connection here with something which we'll make now as our third point here. The first is it was a miracle. Secondly, the food given was basic. simple. And third, there is a link here with manna in the wilderness. Now, on this, rabbinical opinion abounds. The feeding of the Israelites in the wilderness was something the rabbis, something that the Jews couldn't forget. And they expected in the eschatological times a repeat of the miracles of the wilderness. The rabbi said, in their opinion, on Ecclesiastes 1:9, you can find the quotation of this in Cranfield 2:2:2. As the first Redeemer caused manna to descend, so also the last Redeemer caused manna to descend. Reference to Moses and Jesus as an antitype of Moses. In another rabbinical passage, we read, "For whom has the manna now been prepared? For the righteous in the age that is coming. Everyone who believeth is worthy and eateth of it." Another rabbinical passage says, "Ye shall not find manna in this age, but ye shall find it in the age that is coming." Okay, so we see clearly that there was significance in the feeding. And the pious Jews in the audience might have been able to link this event with the Jewish expectation of the Messiah. A false significance of this feeding is the link it may have with the Last Supper. Now, the link between the feeding here, Mark 6:40, and with the Last Supper, Mark 14:22 and following, Mark 14:22 and following, is more a verbal one. The verbal links between these two accounts are significant. The people were seated. Okay, when they had this feast, Jesus took bread. Labon. There is a verbal link. Okay. Bread was used. He blessed the bread. He broke it and he gave it by dividing it. And the people ate. All the people ate. Okay, now you may say, well, these links are quite natural of any situation. But be that as it may, there might be some link between what Jesus is doing here and the Last Supper. There is still a fifth observation we can make, and that is table fellowship. Notice here, quite likely, we have a mixed company. Galilee of the Gentiles includes not only pious and impious Jews, I shouldn't use the word impious, liberal Jews, or in modern terms we would say reformed Jews, but undoubtedly also those who are non-Jews, just Gentiles. Jesus fed all of them. There was no distinction. Jews sit by here, non-Jews sit over there. Now, it may seem not an important point to us, but the Jewish scruples were very clear. If Jesus were feeding the 5,000 in Judea rather than in Galilee, you would find quite likely that there would be such a division, not made by him, but the Jews would naturally segregate themselves without being asked. Okay, the strict Jews did not sit and have fellowship at meals with non-Jews. This reminds me of my work in the prison. I don't know whether you've done any prison ministry, but you find that there's a subculture that is very strong in any prison atmosphere. And that subculture expresses itself in eating, especially. If a prisoner sits with another prisoner, that means he's his friend. He's accepted by him. And the implications are even worse. If you don't sit with your friend, it means you have rejected him. So eating and sitting together has important implications. Nowadays, we just sit anywhere we like without thinking very much. So I want to draw further implications from this. If Peter remembered this situation and used it in his preaching, to the extent that Mark would remember it in his writing of the gospel, then surely we see another indication here. The first indication was at the calling of Levi, Matthew, when there was a meal, Jesus ate with the Gentiles, to the consternation of the Jews. But here we have another situation where it seems Peter did not endorse the rule of table fellowship. Now, why was his behavior in Antioch, Galatians 2? In the other way, it seemed that he was going against his principles. Well, I think that Peter was very pragmatic in that situation. And his pragmatism led Paul to jump up and dispute, you know, his principles. Paul wanted a more consistent lifestyle because he felt that the implications of the rule of table of fellowship, if it is stringently imposed, would affect his Gentile mission drastically. It wouldn't affect Peter as much because he was the apostle to the Jews. Now, you get my point here. The feeding of the 5,000 had some obvious implications, but it had also some underlying implications which we need to see. Yes. You can see the parallel between this and Jesus' use of parables. In fact, Jesus' whole method of teaching and preaching was not to try and make things as plain as possible. He sometimes deliberately left his hearers puzzled. I see this having important pastoral implications. Now, when I'm preaching at one place and I may not see the same group again, it's different. But if week after week I'm dealing with the same group, you know, you find that the spiritual stature is measured by very small increases, noticeable increase of spirituality and increase in knowledge. Sometimes it is good to employ some of Jesus' tactics by confusing the people a bit and startling them, make them think over what you have said, get them angry a little bit maybe, or upset, but later on when they have thought through and gotten out of their complacency, then it is your duty, of course, to clarify things. I know this can be misunderstood, so don't please practice this as a distinctive rule of your characteristic of your ministry. Okay, let's move on to page 138 of the synopsis. The next account now is another miracle of Jesus, a nature miracle again. Jesus walking on water, Mark 6:45 to 52. Oh yes, I'm sure that people knew the miracle. Mark 6:45 to 52, which is paralleled in Matthew and John. My first note is from verse 45, Kai euthus enakasen tus mathetas auton embenai. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat. Why did he do so? I've given you some suggestions. According to one person, he made them decide. He hurried the disciples into the boat so that they may not pass on the idea of the miracle to the crowd, lest the crowd suddenly recognize this is the Messiah and wanted to do more, make him king, maybe. Uh, I doubt if that is the reason. I feel that Jesus hustled the disciples away, not so much to prevent the crowd from knowing, but out of a sense of urgency, because he realized that there is much work to be done, firstly, and secondly, because he was tired and he wanted to get away. He wanted more time with the disciples. But not at that particular moment. The disciples were to go on their own. But sometimes maybe we should not speculate too much and just be prepared to see, well, this is what happened. Jesus had a reason. We may not know exactly what that reason was. A second note here is that there are indications in this account that it is an eyewitness which is describing the situation. Now, Mark was not an eyewitness of that situation. We have basically here a Petrine narrative. Now, we'll have a little exercise now. If we take all the third-person plurals in this account and change them into the first-person plural, you can almost see Peter speaking. Peter, though dead, yet speaking. Okay, like the same thing said of John the Baptist. Now, how would it work? Let's see. In verse 50, I can even go back further. In verse 49, but when we saw him, now Peter speaking on behalf of the disciples, when we saw Jesus walking on the sea, we thought it was a ghost and cried out, for we all saw him and were terrified. And immediately he spoke to us and said, take heart, it is I, have no fear. Jesus got into the boat with us and the winds, for we did not understand about the loaves. At this point here, we'll have to say we did not understand the loaves because our hearts were hardened. Okay, you get the idea here, how there's a kind of vividness in this description which can only come, which can most likely come from an eyewitness. I want to make a note here concerning the phrase in verse 48, peripetratein phulakein, about the fourth watch of the night. Mark here follows the Roman custom of counting four watches. People in those days had no watches, remember that. And they could only tell time approximately. From this time to that time, but they couldn't tell time precisely. Also in verse 48, a note on peripatone. Okay, in verse 48, he came to them walking on the sea. Now we know that peripatone means to walk about. Was Jesus having was he jaywalking on the waters? But it's unlikely that he was jaywalking. Taylor, and what is this? Vincent Taylor says, well, it was dark and the shore was quite near. In the darkness, the disciples couldn't see Jesus wading through the surface of the hidden shore. He was actually walking on the shore, and they misinterpreted the incident as miraculous. Yeah, well, I don't know how they would interpret that, but would not Jesus have quickly discovered their mistake and corrected it? But I'm glad to see Cranfield taking issue with Taylor on this matter. But still, a more preposterous idea is expressed In Mark 6:48, we read, "He meant to pass by them." Now, this is a peculiar statement in Mark, not found in John or Matthew. "He meant to pass by them," which translates, "Kai ethelen pa elthing autus." R.H. Lightfoot, in his commentary, says that Jesus must needs go to help his disciples in distress. But their lack of comprehension was so great and a strain to him that he would have been glad to pass by them. He wanted to go and help them, but they were so dumb and ignorant. So Jesus was so fed up, he just wanted to walk by them. Now, this is not just some fancy country preacher preaching now, but here is a Cambridge Don, an Oxford Don, trying to offer his learned opinion. I'm sorry to be making fun, but I think sometimes rightly so. But a still more interesting point is made concerning verse 52. Now, in verse 52, Mark 52, we read, "For they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened." Kelber, page 37, makes this note. It's interesting that neither Matthew nor Luke would accept this accusation leveled at the disciples. It's true, we see that this is found only in Mark. In Jewish literature, Kelber says, the hardening of the heart intimates disobedience, loss of redemption, and even death. The accusation of Mark is all the more dramatic because in chapter 3, verse 5, Jesus charged his opponents with hardness of heart. Okay, in Mark 3:5. By now applying this accusation to the disciples, Mark had taken the decisive steps towards identifying the disciples as Jesus' opponents. And so he comes up with the same conclusion as the film Jesus Christ Superstar, that Jesus' whole problem was with the disciples. Kelber comes up with this conclusion, and I feel that this is to ameliorate Jewish scruples. You know that the Jewish opinion today is very unhappy about the Gospel's recording of Jesus, especially the portrayal of the Pharisees. They feel that the Gospels are biased. If you speak to any Jew, they will tell you that. And so there's a shift, you know, of emphasis to make the real culprits not the Jewish leaders of Christ's day, but rather the disciples. Now, we recognize that Jesus was rather hard on the disciples. Their relationship is expressed warts and all. But this shows that Mark here was trying to give as faithful an account of what happened. And despite all the harsh words that they say to Jesus, and Jesus said to them, there was an underlying bond of love and commitment that Jesus had. Since he called them, it was his responsibility to work with them, even if he had to scold them and deal harshly with them at times. The next section concerns healings at Gennesaret. Page 139, synopsis. Mark 6:53-56. Here we have a summary statement. Gennesaret is a village southwest of Capernaum, situated in a well-populated plain by the same name. Jesus had crossed over with his disciples now from Bethsaida to this populous place. Now note that Jesus was trying to escape the crowds during this part of his earthly career, but for some reason he decided to go back into the center of population again. The emphasis is here on his healing miracles. And there is no specific mention that is made, but rather a general one. This ties in with Austin Farrer's view, which I've given you earlier, that where Mark describes a specific healing miracle, it is always of a single person being healed. But where he describes generally, he will mention that many were healed. Okay? Note the emphasis is on the poor that received this healing. In verse 55, the sick people came on their krabatoi, on their pallets. Jesus' popularity at this time appears at society. We move on now to page 140, a section missing in Mark, but found in John 6:29 to 59 only. An important section on bread, the bread of life. Now, in the light of what Mark later says in chapter 8 about bread, it seems to me that if he had known this unit of gospel tradition, he would probably have used it, because it would have fitted his motive in writing the gospel very well. And the absence of it in Mark, as well as in the rest of the synoptics, indicates that they didn't know this gospel tradition, or rather, it was excluded for some reason, and therefore John did great service to the Gospels, the writing of Gospels, by including this section. So we move on. Page 141, the section on defilement found in the three synoptic Gospels, Mark 7, 1 to 23. Page 141. Question? The reference is John 6:29 to 59. Generally in Mark chapter 8. Okay. Just leave it to the, as a general reference, because I'm going to be dealing with it soon. Now the reference here is in this section, Mark 7, 1 to 23, to defilement. This is a pronouncement story. In verse 2, we have the word konais. They saw that some of the disciples ate with hens, konais, defiled. The reference here is to ritual uncleanness. It is not that they had dirty hands, but the hands were ritually unclean. In verse 6, notice the strong word Jesus used of them, hypocriton. Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites. In verse 8, Jesus presses a counter charge against the leaders of the Jews. The leaders had told him and his disciples, it is not lawful for you and your disciples to be involved in breaking the Sabbath, giving them an official warning before proceeding with the punishment, which is stoning. Jesus' countercharge to them was in these words: you leave the commandment of God and hold fast the tradition of men. And he goes on to say in verse 13, you are making void the word of God through your tradition. So, what Jesus was trying to say is that to the Pharisees, you are trying to obey the law of the law of God, but in fact, you are breaking it. Now, this is an important section, and it's not easy to understand it, particularly the reference in verse 11 to Korban. Korban. What this is carefully explained as follows. In the light of the background of the use of this word, it is found 80 times in the Old Testament, and it is a word meaning offering. Interestingly, this word is found only in Leviticus, Numbers, and Ezekiel. And it is the hiphil form of a Hebrew word which means to draw near. Or to bring near. It is, therefore, a word which denotes an offering that is taken and set aside, brought near to the altar, placed in that way, as something reserved for God. It is not actually being offered yet. Okay, so it is something which is set aside as being reserved for an offering to God. And therefore, it is not to be touched as a gift for a man, not to be used as a man. So for a person, for a Jew, to declare something as korban was to fix a value on that article of on that article as that this is something dedicated to God. Now, it does not always mean that the thing dedicated was actually offered, was actually to be offered, but simply it means that it is withdrawn from its original intended use. Its original intended use might be for feeding, for food, an animal, for instance, but it is withdrawn and it was therefore no longer available to a particular person. Now, the Pharisees were abusing this principle. So, Jesus Christ spoke very clearly here of a person who abdicates his responsibility to parents. If a man tells his father or his mother, what you have gained from me is korban, that is something given to God, therefore you can no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother. Jesus is denouncing clearly such a practice, and he's trying to press for an honesty, for an honest attitude, as well as the importance of not neglecting one's duty to man in trying to fulfill one's duty to God at the same time. Now, we can see a threefold teaching in this incident. We see here, first, that Jesus is replying to the challenge of the scribes and the Pharisees. In verse 5, by challenging the authority, not so much of the written law, but of the oral law. Okay, he is challenging their halakha, their oral law. H-A-L-A-K-A-H. It was the oral law that the disciples had infringed when they were plucking grain, not the written law. Second point here is that in the last resort, the oral law or tradition was seen as an attempt by men to manipulate the written or divine law. And it points to a misunderstanding of the written law. That was a serious charge against the Pharisees because they prided themselves on their faithfulness to the law. The third point here, Jesus is not here just a champion of the written law against the traditions of men. He's not making himself in that way. Verse 15 actually implies the abrogation of the Old Testament food laws concerning clean and unclean food between verse 15 and verse 8, although that might appear to be one. The key here, we see here, is that Jesus is speaking as a person who fulfills the law. As Paul says, now if we can introduce Romans 10:4, Christ is telos nomu, the end of the law. Telos understood not as the termination point, but rather as the fulfilling point of the law. So the teaching here is that the goal and the innermost meaning of the law was fulfilled by Jesus. Understood in this sense, and you can see that Jesus' words here point to the spirit of the law, which allows within it certain changes. For example, the changes concerning the dietary regulations on unclean and clean food. And with this, we move on to page 144, the Syrophoenician or Canaanite woman. Mark 7, 24 to 30. Now, we have here in this narrative Aramaisms. It is quite clear this was probably a Petrine narrative that Mark here is now recording. If you look at the synoptic parallels, you see that Mark and Matthew are close, except for Matthew 15, verse 24. And I want to comment on this a little while. In Matthew 15, 24, we read, "Uk apestalein, eime eis ta probata ta apolota oiku Israel. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Now, why did Mark leave out this saying in Matthew 15:24? It's not easy to find out, but one can see, one can understand how the Jewish Christians who were Judaizers, now not all Jewish Christians were Judaizers, I'm referring to the problem that Paul met later on. One can understand how the Jewish Christians might have taken Matthew 15:24 too literally, failing to reckon seriously with the mystery of God's choice of the Gentiles as well. The implication here could be that the Jews were the first-class citizens in the kingdom. The Gentiles came in as proselytes. In the Jewish sense, Judaistic sense of a concession to those who wish to believe, but who don't really have the same status, and who must therefore conform to not only the beliefs of the Jews, but the lifestyle of the Jews. Particularly where it concerns the important principle of circumcision and other aspects. But the point here is, Mark leaves this out, and Matthew includes this. There is probably within the motive of Matthew, the reason why he would want to include this, why Mark would leave it out. But the indication in Mark here is certainly quite clear that the Gentiles were not to be excluded from the kingdom. Even though Jesus' words to her may seem as underrating her importance, The reference to the Gentiles as dogs might have been offensive, but notice the humble way in which the Syrophoenician woman accepted that, and of course received the blessing of Christ there. The next section now is 1:4-5 of the synopsis. Jesus heals a deaf mute and many others, Mark 7:31-37, with a parallel passage in Matthew. And notice here the vivid description in Mark, the considerably longer account found in Mark, which is a considerably shorter gospel on the whole than Matthew. Okay, please realize as a study, as a result of your study of Mark, that he may have written the shortest gospel, but some of his accounts are really fuller and more vivid than the other accounts. We have here an account of a healing which occurred in Gentile country after an extensive preaching tour outside Galilee. This is specifically noted in Mark 7:31. It occurred in the region of the Decapolis. We read earlier of an exorcism in Gentile country, the Gadarene demoniac. Here we have a healing miracle. Now, the details, however, of the preaching tour outside Galilee are noted. We are just told Jesus went from the districts of Tyre. We're not told that he actually went into Tyre. He went through Sidon. Again, not implying that he actually spent much time there. But the details are not told us. I'm sure he didn't just go on the merry-go-round. He didn't go walking for the fun of walking. Okay, there must have been some ministry, but it's puzzling why Mark and the other gospel writers do not elaborate on that. It would have been nice to know what was the state of the situation in Tyre and Sidon. But the concentration seems to be south of them. The action of Jesus in verse 7:33 is significant. If you notice, he took him aside. He let this person out to a quiet place. He put his fingers in his ears. He was deaf. He spat and touched his tongue. Now, I'm sure the person concerned, as well as disciples, must have found it difficult to understand. In my culture, it's an offensive act. You know, if you ask a person, take out your tongue, and he spat into his tongue. But that was what Jesus did. And he looked up to heaven and sighed. Now, the vividness of this is very compelling. I can see a person acting it out with all the force of the action here. According to one commentator, all these are to awaken faith in the deaf mute. The deaf mute may not have the faith yet, but this is to awaken faith. Now, whether that is the case or not, we don't know. But we see that Jesus deliberately did not choose to do all his miracles in a stereotype fashion. Okay, in this miracle, incidentally, the person was healed instantly. But in a subsequent event we're going to be seeing at Bethsaida, there was a two-stage healing process. Okay, one must not stereotype Jesus' miracles. Perhaps it is deliberate also, because Jesus didn't want his believers to think that he was performing some kind of a spell, that there was anything magic to it. You know, so you must say the right words and do the right things, and then the right results will come. The Son of God did not require all that. Notice here in this account the failure of the messianic, the quote unquote messianic secret. This person went out and blazed abroad what Jesus did. Okay, we do not necessarily say here that Jesus was trying to keep a secret, but he was trying to keep down. He realized that it is no longer a secret, but he didn't want to let it be spread around any more than he could possibly allow it to do so. Page 145 goes on with the feeding of the 4,000. I move on. Now, Mark 8, 1 to 10, parallel in Matthew. Notice that we are in a section where Mark and Matthew are closely parallel, again, with Luke nowhere to be seen. There is some vagueness in this. Verse 1, entais hemerais, in those days. A vague expression. It is not important, apparently, for Mark to specify exactly when it took place, neither where it took place. But we can assume that this probably occurred in the same region, the Decapolis. And so we see here another example of a parallel miracle in Gentile country. There was a feeding of the multitude in Jewish country. Let's say that here, a parallel account in Gentile country. Now, depending where the boundaries of the Decapolis were, in your maps, you would have to posit that Jesus left Bethsaida. He was in the Gennesaret. Let's say Decapolis. He was in Gennesaret at this point. And probably it took place in the... Well, it was a very well-populated place. Exactly where, we don't know. But one would understand why there would be 4,000 coming to hear him in this place. But one would have difficulty understanding how where he would find 4,000 in Gergesa, which is in the Decapolis across the lake. But we may be wrong. Here we have an account which some commentators say took place in Gentile country. We're not quite sure whether it was a purely Gentile country. It most likely was in Jewish Gentile country. Because we find the Pharisees actively opposing him at Gennesaret. Luke.
This phrase we translate in those days is the essence of that these things occurred at the same time.
Yes. Okay, continuing. Look at verse 8, chapter 8, sorry, verse 7, chapter 8, verse 7. Kai ekan ikludia, oligar. And they had a few small fishes. Now, notice we spoke of ichthus for the 5,000 and onarion in John. Here we have ikludia. They were more like sardines than salmon. The diminutive ending, iota, omicron, nu, here in the plural, iota, alpha, ichthudia, implies small fishes. There were a few small fishes. Okay? How many exactly is not mentioned by Mark?
You said that ending...
Yes. The iota... Alpha ending is what we call a diminutive ending. Okay, just like paidos and paidion. Paidion means a little child. There is a doublet here. A doublet in the sense of a miracle, but I don't see any problem with that. There's no reason why Jesus should not feed the multitude on more than one occasion. Perhaps there is also Eucharistic significance in this, although fish was not used in the Last Supper. But there is, again, no particular problem. I think all the feeding of the multitudes may have some form of connection with the manna, with the giving of the manna. Remember that manna was not given just once in the wilderness, but consistently for a while. We move on to page 146 now, Mark 8:11-13. The Pharisees here ask for a sign. Now, their specific request was Mark chapter 8, verse 11, for a semeion apotu uranu. Apotu uranu reflects, this is an Aramaism or Semitism. You could substitute tu uranu with tu theu. They wanted a sign from God. Now this request shows the spiritual blindness of the Pharisees. They had missed the point in all of Jesus' miracles. They saw the miracles of Jesus as terata, wonders, or as dunamis, not as semeia. Now we come to the important threefold description of the miracles. I want to deal with this a little bit. The synoptists, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, use semeion to denote miracles which are in their nature as signs pointing to the person of Jesus Christ as divine, as signs which compel belief. If a person doesn't believe, look at the miracles of Jesus. There you have your reasons for believing. Okay, this word is used in Matthew 16:1-4, Luke 11:16. Compare 1 Corinthians 1:22. Now the request for a sign as such is regarded as tempting God. Matthew 16:1. And for Christ to give them such a sign, as it were, would be to make faith not so much impossible as to be less than what it really should be. So we can say that the miracles of Jesus are not signs in the sense that they are to be used merely in an apologetic way to persuade unbelieving skeptics to become believers. They were signs in a more important sense, pointing to the person of Jesus Christ. Whether or not people were convinced by these make no difference. Just like, for instance, God is God, no matter whether people believe him as God or not. So the signs or the semeia of Jesus remain as significant signs, whether or not people took them as such. But it's interesting that here, the synoptists prefer to use, it seems, the word dunamis of the miracles of Jesus. Whereas John, the fourth gospel, prefers to use semeion. We can refer to John 2:18. John 4:48. But the three terms point to three aspects. Jesus' miracles were dunamis, they were mighty acts of God. Surely they showed a supernatural person at work. They were at the same time wonders, something that the people had never seen before. I was describing to some of you levitation, you know. Andre Cole is able to perform levitation acts. You cannot imagine how it's possible for a person to just rise up against the law of gravity. But I saw that in Vancouver, this past fall. Semeya would point to the inner significance. I believe Jesus, Peter's walking on water was a wonder how it was possible. People must have doubted, but it seemed that the evangelist didn't comment too much on this, as though the disciples were not so much interested. To me, that would be the talk of the town. You know, if this thing happened, the Taylor's Weekly would have a double issue. Okay, we move on. Page 147. Okay, page 147, Mark 8:14-21, the leaven of the Pharisees. It's significant in verse 14 that only one loaf is mentioned. Eime henna arton. Okay, they could have simply used the anathras arton, but no, henna arton is used. And then more than that, eime henna arton. It is not just one loaf, but only one loaf. They had just one loaf. Well, in the hurry to leave, they forgot to bring bread, we are told. But it could be that since they were in a hurry to leave, Jesus asking them to leave, they perhaps had forgotten to bring bread on that account. I have brought this out to some of you in the tutorials already. I think to most of you, except for one or two who have not had the tutorial, that in the light of the plural artus in this passage, we see therefore a significance. In verse 14a, we see they forgot labain artus, to take loaves. They had only one loaf. Okay? And in verse 16, we have a double use. If you want to use exegetical shorthand, you would just use the Latin phrase bis, B-I-S, underlined, which means twice. Okay, this is found in verse 16, bis, or twice, as artus, artus. Do you have any loaves? Jesus asked. No, we have no loaves, they replied. Okay, I doubt if the significance can be pressed as Kelber does, to say that one loaf represents the unity of Jew and Gentile. But perhaps you can use your ingenuity, I hope biblically, to try and find more significance than I've been able to find in the fact that there is mention of this one loaf. I simply want to point this out and then move on to a comment in verse 4, verse 15 now. Tais zoumes, the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod, is repeated twice. Tais zoumes. Why would Jesus use this particular term? Now, in the New Testament, this term is used in elsewhere in 1 Corinthians 5:6-8 and Galatians 5:9. The rabbis took leaven as having evil connotation. Leaven was a metaphor for an evil tendency in men, which, though it may seem to be a small thing, nevertheless corrupts the whole man. But sometimes leaven can have good connotations, as for instance, in Matthew 13:33. Nevertheless, leaven here in this section, in this incident mentioned in Mark, refers to teaching. As far as the Pharisees were concerned, and it refers to the character of Herod. As far as Herod is concerned, there's a double shape meaning here. In the case of the Pharisees, it was also their hypocrisy arising from their teaching. So maybe we could say that it refers not just to the teaching of the Pharisees, but also to their character as well. But the leaven of Herod here, Herod being suggested by the proximity of Gennesaret to Tiberias, the place where Herod lived, that would be quite easy. It would refer to his adultery, its affectation of piety, and his hatred for John the Baptist and for Christ and other things. Well, I want to go on, if I may, to just one more point on this section. In verse 15, we have a saying of Jesus. We have a pronouncement story here, basically. The saying, beware, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod. Now, scholars have pointed out that it is unusual for Mark to insert a pronouncement or a saying in the middle of a story. Usually, Mark does it at the end. He would describe an incident, and at the end he will say, the Sabbath is not for men. Was not made for men, but... Sorry, man was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath for men. And so for the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. But it's unusual for Mark to insert a saying of Jesus in the middle of an incident. Now, we don't jump to the conclusion and say, well, this is therefore not genuine, but it's a gloss. What is there to prevent Mark from getting out of his rut and occasionally putting a saying in the middle, as he probably does here? I'll have to stop here and continue tomorrow from page 148.